height of the Harlem Renaissance, W.B. Du Bois was doing it all, running Crisis Magazine, giving lectures across the country, running his new organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. But something was missing. Nobody was speaking directly to Black children, so he started a monthly magazine for them. He called it the Brownies Book.
And this one kid wrote in and he said, "Dr. Du Bois, I don't think that parents should whoop their kids, especially since we can understand if you just talk to us. What is your opinion on butt whoopings?" And do you know that Du Bois took that kid's letter seriously? He published that letter. Mm-hmm. And more surprisingly, he wrote a full response to parents. And he's like, wow. "Look, y'all, you need to stop whooping your kids."
From Virginia Humanities, this is With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Today on the show, how Black people have written themselves into the world. Dr. Carita Brown is a professor of sociology at Emory University and a devout W.B. Du Bois fan. As she read through Du Bois' children's magazine, The Brownies Book, she turned to her husband, visual artist Charlie Palmer, and said, "What if we brought this back?" So they reached out to esteemed writers and visual artists and solicited new works for their book called The New Brownies Book, A Love Letter to Black Families. And this spring, it was awarded an NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Nonfiction. With Good Reason producer Lauren Francis interviewed the couple for the Virginia Festival of the Book and then invited them to be with her on With Good Reason. Lauren, you so enjoyed your conversation with Carita and Charlie.
I did love that conversation, talking to them and hearing just the spirit of the book. And I had never heard of the Brownies Book. And so sitting and talking with Carita and Charlie, it taught me so much about the past and the present. And I so loved the group that we had in the room for our panel, too. I mean, there's just so many entry points to this amazing book.
I enjoyed your interview with them. Let's listen.
So tell me about Du Bois' Brownies magazine. What was it?
Ooh. So W.E.B. Du Bois, along with two friends, Augustus Granville Dill and Jesse Redman Fawcett, got together and produced this children's magazine in 1920. It was called The Brownies Book, and it was the very first children's magazine to center Black children as a matter of joy and consequence. And it ran for about a year and a half, and it was published monthly and full of art and poetry, plays, games, photographs, stories. It was just a hodgepodge of love and creativity.
I love when you said that this centered Black children as a matter of joy and consequence. Tell me more about what do you mean by that and what makes that so important, especially at that time?
At that time and this time, I mean, representation matters, but the kinds of representation matter even more. So you can imagine in the 1920s how Black people were represented in the media, not only adults, but children as well as the butts of jokes, scary, criminal, you know, minstrels, right? So there was a lot of negative stereotypes being represented in all forms of media, including print media. So it was so important to, you know, put out a counter narrative where Black people could see themselves the way that we see us, right? And that's what Du Bois and his counterparts were really doing. They were pushing back against a mainstream narrative. And as it comes to children, he thought it was ever important for them to see themselves as actors in a world, as global citizens, as objects of beauty and love and joy. And the Brownies Book wasn't just about fun and games. Du Bois also talked to them about politics and, you know, what was going on in the world, and invited them to engage in issues that mattered to children. So the magazine had weight to it.
So where was Brownies distributed? Was it just in the American South?
No, it was a national magazine, but I did see in one issue a letter that came in from a young boy in Canada. So apparently the Brownies book made itself across U.S. borders, so it was widely distributed.
Just for context, what was going on in Du Bois' life at this time? Like, he didn't necessarily have free time. What was going on in his life?
Oh, my goodness. Okay, so W.E.B. Du Bois, sociologist, activist, organizer, scholar. He was the foremost Black intellectual of his time. Around this time in the 1920s, he is the editor-in-chief of the Crisis magazine. Okay, he had just co-founded the Pan-African Congress in London. He had authored at least 10 books by this time. And yet and still, he made the time to create the Brownies book because he thought that Black children were that important.
Hmm. Do you all have any favorite pieces from the original Brownies?
Du Bois had this column that was kind of like Ann Landers, you know, column where kids could write in with questions or whatever, ask Dr. Du Bois. And this one kid wrote in and he said, "Dr. Du Bois, I don't think that parents should whoop their kids, especially since we can understand if you just talk to us. What is your opinion on butt whoopings?" And do you know that Du Bois took that kid's letter seriously? He published that letter. And more surprisingly, he wrote a full response to parents. And he's like, "Wow. Look, y'all, you need to stop whooping your kids. They are little human beings with the full range of emotions. You need to talk to them so that they can have understanding and build character." You know, he read them up and down about the overuse of spanking as a way to discipline and develop children. And I just thought that was remarkable, not only that Du Bois stood on business on the side of children, and also that that kid had the gumption to write that in to Du Bois, you know?
I love that so much. So the Brownies periodical was only in print for 1 year, from 1920 to 1921. What happened? Why was it only in print for that short period of time?
Oh, Lauren, Du Bois was helping to finance the Brownies book. So he did have some support from the NAACP, but a lot of the production money came out of his own pocket. And he just simply couldn't afford to keep it going. And he was just heartbroken to have to discontinue it. Even years later, in 1935, he's reaching out to folks trying to find funding to revive the Brownies book. So he never gave up on it and never stopped thinking about it. But that was it. It was a short run.
What was the aha moment for you all when you were like, "Oh, we have to create the new Brownies. We have to bring this back"?
We were in the midst of the pandemic. We had had a conversation earlier about the idea of someone needs to do it. And it's relevant now as it was then. Probably in some ways even more relevant now because there's too much information overload. I think this Brownie book asked everyone to slow down for a little bit, to look at, enjoy your children, enjoy your family, enjoy humor, enjoy. And so we started thinking about how Du Bois initially created this, where he reached out to some of the greatest writers and Black artists of the time and asked for them to contribute. And we were aware that we had our own personal contemporary Rolodex, our phones, and saying, "Listen, we know a lot of great writers. We know a lot of great artists. You think they would do it?" And so when we composed a letter and made some personal phone calls, we got like a resounding yes from pretty much everyone we asked to be a part of it.
So, of course, the original Brownies was a monthly periodical, and what you guys have created is the new Brownies book, A Love Letter to Black Families, which is not, maybe right now, a periodical. Tell me a bit about the structure of it. How did you all decide what to include and what was really important to speak to at this time?
You know, so what we did, we collected all the works. We gave no direction. We didn't even reach out to Black artists or authors and say, make it Black. Tell your story. Share what you want to share. And so as we started to collect all the essays and at the same time the artwork, we began to start thinking about how this all comes together. And at that point, we started thinking about what the rhythm of the book would be. And what I love about what Kieran Lewis, who is a British Black designer, did was he had these moments in the book that are blank or with a warm brown color. And those were the moments of a pause, as it would be in the beat of poetry or the beat of music. And so it has these moments, whether it's a topic of intense truth or joy, there's these pauses in between for the next one. And there's always the surprise in the next direction.
And we had help. We established a undergrad editorial board at Fisk University, and they read every single piece that came in, and we discussed the pieces, the emotional content of the pieces. So shout out to the Fisk interns.
This book was created out of spirit, out of soul, out of love. And we were having a house built in Atlanta. And so we decided, let's move to Nashville for a year.
We shed like extra love on Fisk. And it's because of that. Du Bois graduated from Fisk before moving on to Harvard. Later in life, he said, I'm Harvard trained, but I'm always a Fisk man. You know, learn about HBCUs. Go visit some. Look them up. See what they're about. They're a vital part of our legacy.
I want to ask about another section, which is maybe right now my favorite section. I think that'll just keep changing because it's really a wonderful book. But the third chapter, so to speak, is dedicated to Langston Hughes's early work. Why was that so important to you all?
When it came to Langston Hughes, early on, he corresponded with Du Bois and submitted some essays and some poems and wanted to get feedback. Like really reached out to this man and say, hey, what do you think of my writing? And so, and I think at the time he was around 17 years old, just about to graduate high school. And so what we thought was very important is, again, one of the greatest American writers of all time, Langston Hughes, published his very first works in the Brownies book.
And this is like Langston Hughes before he was Langston Hughes. This is high school Langston Hughes, who's just trying to find his voice, right? And he knew that he had a talent, but he wanted to develop a craft.
In the new Brownies book, you all were actually blessed to publish a poem by a five-year-old, Zoe Jones. Would you be willing to read that for me, Karita?
Sure. And Zoe's poem is in the Family Ties chapter, and it's titled, Kisses Make Things Better, But Sometimes They Don't. Kisses make bad dreams better, but they don't make hard things feel soft. They make ouchies feel better, but kisses don't make cuts stop hurting. They don't make water safer, but they do make swimming fun. Kisses make things better that are sad, but not everything that is bad. Because sometimes kisses make things better, but sometimes they don't.
Amazing. I love that poem.
Yeah, Charlie loves the, what is it, the honesty in it?
It's the truth in it, yeah, and the way it is. We don't live happily ever after, but we do, we do live on.
And I understand that Zoe's hand has been hurting from signing all these autographs
in
school and like everyone just, you know.
Zoe,
the owner.
The poet laureate, Zoe Jones.
So she's seven now, I think. And she's submitting poems to us regularly now.
Yes.
Yeah, amazing. She's a poet now.
So you might have to make this a monthly periodical. The calling may be on you.
That's the second time you didn't mention that, Lauren.
I just want to keep planting the seed. So then when you start dreaming about it and you're like, Okay. Okay. The spirit of Du Bois has come to us. So it feels important to me to speak to at this point, too, the fact that although this book is, you know, a love letter to Black families, to me, it's not restricted to just being something that Black people can read or get something from. Could you all speak to that?
Absolutely. And that's why we've said from the outset, we want this book to be on the coffee table of every family in America, because it is a book that explores the complexities and joys of the human experience, and that transcends any racial or ethnic category. It just happens to be expressed through Black creatives. So Du Bois said this in the original Brownies book, and we stand on this as well. He says, the Brownies book is a thing for all children, especially ours.
Well, Dr. Karita Brown, Charlie Palmer, thank you so much for chatting with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you so much, Lauren. This was amazing.
We had a great time. Thank you.
Dr. Karita Brown is a professor of sociology at Emory University. Charlie Palmer is a visual artist and her husband. They're based in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, hello, Central. Give me Dr. J.
From climate change to the pandemic, the end times are always coming. And for some people, they're always already here. Brenton Boyd argues that many Black Americans and Caribbeans imagine the end of the world differently because for them, the rapture has always been now and has been survived many times over. Brenton Boyd is a Virginia Humanities HBCU Scholar Fellow and PhD candidate at Emory University. Brenton, you've said that Black people have already thought about the terms of their extinction. What does that mean? Have already thought about the terms of their extinction?
Yes, what I'm trying to get at is a sense of Black living in and in spite of Black dying. By this, I mean that Black folks have a history of attending to the means by which they die in ways that actually open them up to new forms of life and new forms of living. So, for example, you can think of environmental catastrophe or collapse in the Caribbean, where African Americans and Caribbeans have navigated the environmental world to imagine life in and through moments of intense geological pain. What I'm really trying to get at is that Black people had worked a miracle, creating life in a place where there is said to be no life possible. And I think that there's something magical about that. And I really wanted to center that in my work.
And you mean that it's magical beyond simply that they have survived in spite of the many perils?
Yes. And this is where in my work, I specifically turn to practices like the African-American conjuring tradition, oftentimes called hoodoo or conjure. Hoodoo is one magical practice, religious spiritual practice, that orients one to an entire way of living in and through the environment. And it requires you to attune yourself even to the pain of the environment, the death of the physical world. But it's not just to attune ourselves to the world's pain, but to help the world and therefore help ourselves forge new terms of living in spite of death. Hoodoo or conjure as a practice dates back to the arrivals of Africans in the New World. They are attuned and work with the natural world through elements like botanical objects, plants, graveyard dirt, to conspire against terms of injustice that the world brings them, specifically through enslavement, Jim Crow, and even today to things like police brutality.
Help me see that. Give me some specific examples where you see this happening in voodoo conjure tradition.
I'll give you one example from a more contemporary hoodoo practice and root worker that I engage here in Georgia, where I'm currently based. I work with a number of root workers and African and Caribbean who use techniques not only belonging to hoodoo or conjure, but also to their own practices in places like Cuba, practices like Lukumi, for example. And here in Atlanta, there is a major sort of revolution happening around policing and the consumption of land. You may have heard of what we call Cop City. And so Stop Cop City has become now an entire network of activists organizing against the creation of a policing complex in rural areas outside of Atlanta. And we see that amongst those Stop Cop City protesters, there is a vibrant group of conjurers who are actively using their spells and their environmental knowledge to rebel against Cop City, to hex, or in African-American vernacular, to fix Cop City in such a way that will not only liberate themselves from regimes of anti-Black policing, but also allow them to connect with the environment that is being destroyed using techniques like throwing graveyard dirt on the ground where Stop Cop City protests occur. Working with the dead, having and holding ceremonies of divination to actually think with and to feel with the wisdom of the departed around what they should do as an act of protest and revolution.
You also say that dancehall music, in particular Jamaican dancehall music, is another example of how Black individuals have tried to create a space between life and death. How would dancehall music create that?
Absolutely. And for those who may not be familiar with the context of Jamaican dancehall, outside of Jamaica, it's oftentimes reduced to a mere set or manifestation of homophobic violence. There was a major campaign coming out of the UK called Stop Murder Music. Stop Murder Music was essentially a rallying cry for Northern, in this case, European and American human rights organizations to step in and to, in many ways, demonize Jamaican dancehall music as a site of regression, as a site of backwardsness, even. And so it wasn't just a call to stop homophobia in the Caribbean, but it became a call to end dancehall in general. What I found in my research was that queer, trans, and non-binary Jamaicans, both on the ground in places like Kingston, Jamaica, but also abroad in other places like here in Atlanta or London, for example, for them, dancehall became a site of joy and of life-making and of revelry. And so I set off to ask myself a series of questions. What are the terms? What are the magical terms, even, on which queer Jamaican dancehall performers forge and imagine relationships with life that, in this case, come across as perhaps turning towards sites of death and sites of pain?
You grew up in New Orleans. Did you have the seed of this idea of finding joy in the midst of Black precarity there in your boyhood?
I did, and I think that, quite frankly, that was a place where I had to reckon with the stakes of this work and the stakes of Black death at a very young age. Hurricane Katrina, at my ripe old age of 7 years old when that happened, really forced me to reckon with the facts and the terms of my own extinction. Looking at neighbors, friends, family members losing their homes, losing access to food and water and clean shelter. But also, quite frankly, it literally made me see Black death in such a way that I had not seen up until that age. After Katrina, New Orleans residents ended up reclaiming the terrains, the rich roots of their own pre-Katrina legacy in the second line dance or even the jazz funeral. And those cultural artifacts took on new meaning after Katrina. And so the jazz funeral incarnates a spiritual space in which Black New Orleanians are able to renegotiate the terms of living literally in context with or in collaboration with the dead.
Has the second line and the jazz funeral procession changed after Katrina?
Absolutely. Quite literally, there are routes that we can no longer take to get to certain cemeteries in New Orleans.
Did you grow up with jazz funerals in New Orleans pre-Katrina?
Yes, I did. My family is also military. So even when we left New Orleans in my teenage years, it became an incredible sight for me of sort of transferring that jazz funeral even outside of New Orleans proper, right? And so my family, for example, has a rich tradition of celebrations of life rather than funerals. And at these celebrations of life, there is always intense dancing, intense music, intense revelry. And so while there is also mourning and crying, there is also laughter and joking at the funeral. And so in some ways, we take the jazz funeral with us wherever we go. And I think that that is one of the ways that New Orleans jazz funerals becomes infectious for Black folks all over the United States. And so Black people, even in Chicago, even in California, even in New York, have cultural systems of relating to the funeral as a moment, not just of sadness, but as an event of joy and reflection and memory.
Is there a song that you particularly love as part of either the jazz funerals or funerals that you've taken with you and your people and family have taken with you outside of New Orleans that we could close on?
Absolutely. One of my favorite jazz funeral hymns and religious songs in general that we oftentimes sing at funerals throughout the African diaspora is a hymn called "I'll Fly Away."
Brenton Boyd is a Virginia Humanities HBCU Scholar Fellow and PhD candidate at Emory University. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back. At the turn of the 20th century, William Grant Still and Undine Smith Moore were composing great music. They were the grandchildren of enslaved Black Americans, and they had a reverence for the hymns and spirituals that kept their foremothers and forefathers strong, the hymns and spirituals that kept them strong. Bianca Jackson is a professor of music at Norfolk State University and at Alcorn State University in Mississippi. She's also a 2023-2024 Virginia Humanities HBCU Scholar Fellow. She says that Still and Moore were determined to use their music to speak out on what was happening in the world around them. Bianca, you've been studying early 20th century Black composers for decades. Which composer did you first fall in love with? How old were you?
I actually fell in love with the music of William Grant Still. But when I made it to undergrad at Tougaloo College in HBCU, we had a chapter on classical music, and I discovered that William Grant Still had been born in Mississippi, and actually right pretty much down the road from where I live. And I was so excited because here was a person who had gained like international success with classical music, and I've never really heard about him before, and I was just astounded by his talent and also just by the message in his music of promoting Black people through music.
He's considered the father of Black composers in the 20th century. Why is that? Why does he stand out?
Yes, William Grant Steele is known as being the first Black American composer to have success with a symphony orchestra being performed by a major orchestra. He was the first to conduct a major orchestra, the first to have an opera televised on national television. And he just had so many lists of accomplishments. You know, he got Guggenheim fellowships, honorary doctorates from various universities. He did scoring for popular music as well as film, radio. He worked with jazz orchestras, classical. He wrote in numerous forms, opera. He basically did everything you can imagine with music, both popular and classical. And that is why he is known as the Dean of African American Composers.
And you've also said that his wife wrote a lot of the scripts for the operas. And you can tell in his operas that they really have strong women themes.
Yes. So with Steele, he worked with his wife, Verna Arvey, who was a concert pianist. She also was a journalist. So she had that intuitive sense about the music, and they really made such a great team. So much so, with one of the operas he was working on, Troubled Island, he was initially working with Langston Hughes. But when Hughes was no longer able to work on the opera, Arvey stepped in and started helping with the libretto. Because they made such a great team, she became the librettist for all of the rest of his operas, and she gave a lot of agency to women in the opera plot. You know, traditionally in operas, women are the ones who are usually victimized. But what really makes these operas stand out is the women who have the power to really make things happen and move the plot. If you know about the histories of a lot of the operas, the storylines, that's not something that usually happens.
Give me an example of one of those and play a little bit from it that show the strong woman character.
Sure. So in Troubled Island, you have a young mother, Celeste, who is singing to her child as the slaves are thinking about a rebellion for freedom. As she talks to her child, she is talking about there's just the need for freedom and just the dreams they have of a better world for her child. Let's listen to Troubled Island, Celeste's aria, Little Black Slave Child. Actually, at a time where everybody is really in a mood of excitement and anticipation. The setting is in Haiti during the slave rebellion in an abandoned sugarcane plantation. And so you can just really sense how much hope Celeste has and her dreams that maybe this time they can actually get freedom.
He also wrote Bayou Legend. Tell me about Bayou Legend, because you've said that this is another strong woman protagonist character, and I'd love to hear a piece from this one.
Yes. So a Bayou Legend is an opera based upon a Mississippi folk legend. And so in this opera, you have a town that's pretty much, you know, people living a simple life. You know, they go to church. They, you know, pretty much law-abiding people. But in this opera, you have pretty much a love triangle between a spirit, the protagonist, and then another woman. So the spirit is Aurora. The main character is Basile. And then you also have Clotilde. And this opera is really unique because the women, you have Aurora the spirit. She pretty much represents, you know, goodness, the spiritual world, the ethereal. And then you have Clotilde. She represents lust, worldly things. And so you have Basile, who is caught between these two worlds, and he must make a choice. He ultimately chooses the spiritual. He chooses Aurora, but that comes at the cost of him losing his life because the town has strict rules that you do not, quote unquote, consort with spirits.
And Clotilde speaks for me.
Is it true that you consort with evil spirits?
The spirit I consort with is not evil.
And when Clotilde finds out that he's, you know, talking to a spirit woman instead of her, she has it out for him. So I would like to play a Bayou legend, Clotilde's aria, Now They Will Be Coming to the Tree. And in this aria, she wants to see Basile lynched because he refuses to marry her. She has told him that she is carrying his child, which we really don't know whether that's true or not, but Basile denies this, and when he refuses to marry her, she decides that he must die, because that's the rule of the town, that, you know, if you consort with spirits, you die. So I would like to play Clotilde's aria, Now They Will Be Coming to the Tree.
Now they will be coming to the tree. Fashioned a noose while the others hold Basile. Now it will be thrown over a high branch and left to dangle around Basile's neck. Now they will draw it tight. Up will go.
Yes. And when you listen to this, Clotilde's like grisly description of what happens during this lynching, this hanging, you can make comparisons in jazz and popular music to Billie Holiday's version of Strange Fruit, which she also describes what happens, you know, during a lynching. And so this is one of the reasons why I say that even though this opera isn't as well known, it also has important commentary about things that were actually happening in the world during that time.
You've also done a deep dive with Undine Smith Moore. Tell me about Undine Smith Moore.
Yes, so Undine Smith Moore is known as the Dean of Black Women Composers. And if you look at her life, she is a daughter of Virginia. She talks about growing up in Virginia, the community was really invested in the music education of its children. And she was one of those children who had like fantastic music teachers, and they really encouraged her to pursue a musical career. So she actually went and studied at Fisk University. And if you know about Fisk, they have the Fisk Jubilee Singers, which are known as one of the earliest concert choirs in the HBCU tradition. And so they were the ones who were really credited with popularizing African-American spirituals, arranged spirituals, and really setting that I guess you would call it that model of classical music and African-American genres being really fused together, a model that so many composers follow afterward. So just with her history, she went to Fisk. She also had connections with Juilliard, with Columbia. So she went to the top institutions. And so you can really tell just high intellect, high musical talent. She played piano, she had organ, she knew music theory, just all of these things, and composition, of course. And so she went off and she had a chance to actually be a major in performance studies, but she decided that she wanted to be a teacher. And I think that is something that really speaks to her nature of wanting to serve and wanting to give back to other people as she had been given, because she spent over 40 years teaching at Virginia State. She was really into writing choral compositions, and she talked about how hearing those spirituals from her mother and just as a child growing up has such an influence on her. And she used that material later on to combine it with classical music. And she's just really fantastic. All the things that she did, she's known mostly for her choral works, but she also has oratorio, Scenes from the Life of a Martyr, based upon the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. And for that composition, she actually was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize back in the 80s. And so that is her monumental work that she contributed, tying in, once again, this social justice, social protest element, and really just taking the music and showing that just even beyond entertainment purposes, music has a message and it has an impact. And that's really something that I want people to take away from the composers that we're talking about today.
Play several selections from her that you think really illustrate her most powerful work.
Sure. So let's begin with Watch and Pray. So this is really a gut-wrenching spiritual. It is talking about a family, a child maybe is asking, is Master going to sell us? And if you can just really ponder on what that would mean for a family, a mother, a child, to have your child ask, will they be sold tomorrow? It's really a lot to take in. So I would like to start there.
Mama, is Mesa gonna send us
gosh, that is gut-wrenching.
Yes, absolutely. And if you hear as the soprano's voice just kind of goes into this melodic line that you can feel like the anguish, and it's almost like a wail, but it's in a classical format. So that's really the, I guess, the beauty of what Undine Smith Moore is able to do. She's able to combine these different elements, the Western European and the African American, into one, and it really makes a seamless hold. And then it's also the text. The mother instructs the child to watch and pray. So this touches upon really that strong spiritual foundation that many enslaved Africans had to rely upon to be able to make it through something as horrendous as slavery.
Let's play another selection from Undine Smith Moore.
Yes. So now I would like to switch to what was Undine's Pulitzer-nominated oratorio. So an oratorio is a work for chorus and orchestra. Some of the famous oratorios, if people think about like in the winter season or different holiday seasons, they do Handel's Messiah. That's probably one of the most well-known oratorios. But this one here, Undine is taking Dr. Martin Luther King as the subject matter and really putting it into a large form. So you hear the orchestra and you really hear the magnitude of the life of Dr. King expressed through music. So this is number one from Scenes from the Life of a Martyr. Whenever a people is oppressed, they wait in hope.
What a powerful piece.
Yes, so that is scene one. Number one, whenever a people is oppressed, they wait in hope. And yes, you can really hear the power of the voices, the choir, and the orchestra.
Bianca K. Jackson, thank you for talking with me on With Good Reason.
Thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate being here. Thank you.
Is there a piece from Undine that you could play for us as we're going out?
Absolutely. So I would like to play a spiritual, Come Down Angels, because like I said, we're talking about the Black experience and using traumatic experiences as like that center or that lens to look at it. But in the midst of the trauma, Black people were also able to triumph. And I feel like a lot of the spirituals show that, you know, it's not just about, you know, the troubles, it's about the things that you overcome. And I feel like Come Down Angels by Undine Smith Moore is an excellent example of that.
Trouble the water, come down angels, trouble the water.
Bianca Jackson is a professor of music at Norfolk State University and Alcorn State University in Mississippi. Bianca is a 2023-2024 Virginia Humanities HBCU Scholar Fellow. With Good Reason is produced by Virginia Humanities, which acknowledges the Monacan Nation, the original people of the land and waters of our home in Charlottesville, Virginia. Our production team is Allison Quantz, Matt Darrow, Lauren Francis, and Jamal Milner. Aviva Costo and Andrew Rice are our interns. Special thanks to Jenny Taylor for booking assistance. For the podcast or to comment, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.